the last two of Prokofiev's Five Melodies, Opus 35. The violinist playing them there, Vadim Repin, and the pianist was Boris Berezovsky. And Prokofiev's magnificent Fifth Symphony closes the first of tomorrow night's proms, one that includes Wagner's Wesendonck songs and opens with Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet. Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts the Rotterdam Philharmonic. And that's all from 7 o'clock tomorrow night, live from the Royal Albert Hall, here on BBC Radio 3. Where it's now a 10:15, and now for one of our proms composer portraits recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome. We're all here to meet Paramveer, the composer of the new work in this evening's prom, Cave of Luminous Mind, and to find out more about his music with the help of young performers from the Royal Academy of Music in London, who'll be playing three pieces of chamber music by Veer for us, one of which will be a world premiere, so the second we're going to hear this evening. And it's a piece that's intimately linked with his prom's commission, as we'll be finding out. Now, Param, the first piece we're going to hear is Constellations from 2010, written for the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group. Is it literally a depiction of patterns of stars and the way they move around?
I think I try not to depict anything, because I think when I was very young, I used to do that. I think about the energy or the emotion behind that idea, whether it's a constellation of stars or a mythological subject, and I act from the emotion and the feeling of that, and that might translate into something that people might relate to directly.
But in terms of the organization of the piece, we have a fairly constant ritornello, which is depicting the Milky Way in some way,
yes.
Or at least the energy of the Milky
it's
Way.
It's twinkly.
Exactly, and we have three separate constellations which you've chosen. Explain how they work and how they interact.
Well, the constellations have different colors and different rhythms in each set of constellations. And what I did was organize them as a kind of a mobile piece with small fragments that the musicians can play in any order. So the Milky Way is a ritornello, which returns and which is fully scored and plays from beginning to end. I think it's about 2 minutes long. And then you have interspersed between that constellations of stars, and those are mobiles for the instrumentalists. In fact, the performance you're going to hear now has never ever before happened in the history of music because they're going to choose the fragments spontaneously, responding to each other. I think even the conductor doesn't know who's going to play what first. So it's always a magical thing. Sometimes in the rehearsal, you find extraordinary things happen because of the conjunction of these mobiles.
And we should just say that the three constellations are Orion, which is led by the piano, isn't
it? That's right.
And then the plough, that's percussion section.
Mm-hmm.
You won't miss that.
No.
And Pegasus, which is the
dancing horse,
yeah. Well, I think we should hear it. To perform Constellations by Paramveer, please welcome our ensemble from the Royal Academy of Music and conductor Karin Hendrickson.
Thank you. Thank you.
three soloistic constellations, Orion the Plough and Pegasus moving alongside the ritornello of the Milky Way. That was Constellations by Param Veer, performed by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London. Flautist Emma Howland, clarinetist Oliver James, violinist Kate Southers, cellist Ireal Evans, percussionist Tom Lee, harpist Olivia Jagers, pianist Masahito Yamaguchi, and they were all conducted by Karen Hendrickson. And the next piece we're going to hear involves just two performers, cellist and percussionist, so there's going to be some rearrangement of the stage behind us as we're talking, Param. So listening to Constellations, it instinctively feels as though, well, exactly what you said just before we heard it, that the energy is the starting point, but you're more concerned about energy and movement and colour than perhaps about architecture and any kind of method when it comes to your compositions.
Well, in this piece, it's not that architectural. It's a short piece. But of course, larger pieces, you have to write architecturally, as I've done with the orchestral work.
And with the difference between these two pieces, the large orchestral Proms Commission and Constellations we've just heard, is the starting point for you the same? You begin with this idea of the sound and the energy, and then some kind of notation you draw, I think, don't you?
Yes, the starting point for all my pieces is in that sense the same, in that it you want to find within yourself something that you want to write about and say with some conviction and feeling. I think without feeling, there isn't any point in writing the music. So I must be sure that I really want to write this piece and what the feeling is about. And then this leads to a sound impression, which can come from different sources. Sometimes you may just start with the sound and you suddenly realize that this is linking to something else. And then I normally get a very vivid sound impression, which I can only describe as a kind of sound sculpture. I hear the music, obviously, not in all detail, but I hear the music and I also see a visual sculpture. It isn't a sculpture of a work of art. It's just something to do with lines and colors and so on, shapes. And I draw that out very quickly because that's a way in which you can put the idea down very strongly and very accurately without messing around with notation and pitches and ledger lines and staffs of music and treble clefs and bass clefs, you know. It's a graphical. I don't think I would call it art in any sense. It's simply energy, a shorthand, an energy imprint of this way the sound would appear to a listener.
So an energy imprint, I like that idea. And then what's the next step?
Well, I call them energy templates, as it happens. And then from that, you get what I usually do is write a rhythmic template. And the rhythmic template is a very exact barring, controlling of the time sequence of the piece, the orchestration. It will contain the way the sections change, the way groups of instruments would come in and out. And it's very exactly rhythmic. It doesn't have any pitch. The pitch formations are happening quite separately, and you put them down on pitch schemes. And then you have to blend the two together to create a whole image.
So that rhythmic organization is the point at which the structure really comes into focus for you.
Quite. That would be a good way to describe it. It comes into focus with the rhythmic template.
I was just curious because I was reading that you were exposed to serialism, the second Viennese school, the new Viennese school, very early in your life as a musician. You were just a teenager, weren't you, I think?
I was 14 years old and I was in New Delhi, and there was nobody really in India who could have taught me composition. But the director of the Goethe Institute happened to be a gentleman called Hans Joachim Kohlreuter, who had fled the Nazi era in Germany and gone to Brazil, where he took the 12-tone system. So I was his student for 2 years, and he was the director of the Goethe Institute in Delhi. They don't call it that, they call it the Max Müller Bhavan. And he introduced me to 12-tone technique. I still have a copy of Webern's Opus 27, the piano variations. Immediately after that, I modeled a song called The Beggar, which had the same structural idea in the tone row, the way the tone row is used. But of course, I've departed from that a long time ago.
And I'm curious about other elements of your early life as a musician, because, well, you were born in Delhi. Your mother was a singer, I believe. She sang in the North Indian classical tradition. So this was the music you were steeped in. What made you move allegiance, as it were, to Western classical tradition?
I have no idea. I think it's mysterious, these decisions we make. She did try to get me interested in Indian classical music, and I think even had some tabla lessons, which I picked up later on when I was much older in college. But I didn't sort of take to it, though the house was full of music, and she used to sing classical Indian music. But when she suggested that I should learn the piano, and I was walking through my new school, and we heard the piano teacher there playing something, La Paloma, I think it was, on the piano, she thought I should take piano lessons, and I agreed. That's how it started.
So immediately with piano lessons, the tradition changed.
And of course, I'd also encountered the Blue Danny Waltz, which is the first piece of Western music I heard. So these were my antecedents, as it were.
And how did these influences and first exposure to composers like Beethoven, for example, which I know you listened to in Karajan's recordings, and how did these mix with your background in Indian music? What sort of teeming mixture of things was going on in your teenage mind?
I don't really know. I was studying with Kohlreuter. I studied 16th century counterpoint, which I still insist that all my students should study. And in a sense, I always say that my pieces are crafted with the background of 16th century counterpoint, which means independence of lines, independence, you know, of the climax points, and so on, and rhythmic diversification between the parts. And also a strict control of pitches in terms of consonants, dissonance, and so on. So that was a very powerful influence. It was also, I was in a Catholic, Roman Catholic school, though I'm not a Roman Catholic, and they drafted me to play the harmonium in their school chapel. So I used to accompany Gregorian plain chant, playing two chords. You know, when it went up, it went to D minor. When it went down, it went back to A minor or something. And I had to figure out when the chord changed. So actually, I remember Gregorian plain song from my boyhood, and how many people can claim that? You know, I mean, there are people like Maxwell Davis that, you know, were steeped in the plain song very early on. But bizarrely, so was I in Delhi.
And this is still something you can call on in your compositions.
I do. I still remember it. I remember the plain song. It's very powerful.
I know you'll always be asked this question about the influence of Indian tradition and Indian music on your compositions, but there's one element of the way you write which makes me curious about it, which is this idea of rhythm and rhythmic cells, because when you look at your scores, you see relatively few of the more traditional Western time signatures, the 3/4s, the 4/4s, the 6/8s. You see a great deal more flexibility. Do you think that comes from Indian tradition, the taal, the rhythmic cells that Indian music uses?
I do use the taals, but I don't use Indian taals. I invent my own taals. And I have also, so it's actually very much in the way in which Messiaen uses taals. Their taals have very light and heavy characteristics in the teka, in the basic pattern of the taal. And sometimes I imitate that in the orchestration. But I'm not really interested in simply sticking elements of Indian music into my own music so far. However, having said that, this piece, Consolations, which we just heard, is in fact an example of an idea from Indian classical music. Because when you hear two or three players improvise on the stage, they are also making up spontaneously very, very fast decisions about what patterns they will play in conjunction with what. So it all happens spontaneously, which is sort of what happens in the in the three consolation movements.
Now, what about this next piece? Because there's a major percussion part in this. Percussion and cello. It's called Beyond the Reach of the World, and it's inspired by the writings of a Danish resistance fighter in the Second World War who was tortured by the Nazis and sentenced to death. Can you describe how the words he left behind became music for you?
Well, I have been appalled by torture, and I didn't obviously want to write a piece about torture, but what Kim went through in that Nazi prison was pretty extreme. And he came out of it unconscious, and then he began to draw on the cave, on the cell of his prison cell, on the walls, with some piece of chalk or some pencil he had, a drawing. And then he continued, and he filled the whole wall with drawings of his childhood. And he felt by doing that, that he was able to lift his spirit out of that extraordinarily painful experience of torture, and very brutal torture, to a place beyond the reach of the world where nobody can reach him, and he felt pure. And he had no hatred for his abusers, no hatred for the people that had done this to him. It was truly visionary to experience something that's so violent and then produce this extraordinary response through, in a way, art. So my piece is just a meditation on what he might have felt, as I can see it, as I can feel it.
And that's There's the first part of the piece as well, isn't it? Which is what we're going to hear.
Yeah. Sometimes people think that they hear things in the piece that remind them of some aspect of this story, but I haven't pictorialized anything.
Well, we're going to hear the first part, these images of aliveness and childhood memory, as you've put it. And let's have to perform the first part of Beyond the Reach of the World, cellist Iriel Evans and percussionist Tom Lee.
Thank you.
Childhood Memories Counteracting the Effects of Torture. That was the first part of Beyond the Reach of the World by Param Veer, written for cellist Rohan Dasaram. And you've just heard it played at this proms composer portrait by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, cellist Iriel Evans and percussionist Tom Lee. The sound of almost an exhalation of breath at the end there, Param. Was that what you had in your mind?
The piece ends, in fact, with a slow movement, which we didn't have time to play. So we cut through to the end because it would have been too long. And at the end of the piece, the cello just bows for about a minute on the bridge, simulating breathing.
And you print in the score itself the words of the Danish resistance fighter, Kim Malte Bruun, and they're so beautiful and so powerful and desperately sad as well. Were you not tempted as an operatic composer to set them for voice?
I have set them for voice. This piece was preceded by another piece in 1997 when I wrote for a percussion ensemble, a baritone and piano, virtuoso piano, quite a large piece called Ultimate Words, Infinite Song. And it was the text. He was told he was going to be shot dead the next day, and they were all allowed to write one or two letters to their near and dear ones. And he wrote this letter to his then, well, to his girlfriend called Hannah. And I set extracts of that letter.
So this effectively becomes reflections on that experience and that process as well.
It's there in the background, I suppose, yeah.
Right. Well, the last piece we're going to hear is a world premiere. It's Intimations of Luminous Clarity. Now, you might guess from the title of it that it has a pretty strong connection with the Proms Commission this evening. How does it actually work? What is the relationship between the two pieces?
Well, once I'd finished most of my orchestral work, and the idea for this concert came up with the musicians of the Royal Academy, I very much decided to write a new piece. And I took the piano music of the orchestral work, the piano part of the orchestral work, and because it's written with the same ethos of 16th century counterpoint, though I assure you it doesn't sound anything like that, it means that the piano part has its own integrity and its own line and its own form. So I took that, I printed it off onto large A3 sheets of paper, and I crawled all over it, scribbling other notes and extending it, sometimes turning it upside down and so on. So I wrote about 80% more material. I didn't take all the fragments from the orchestral piece, but I took some as a starting point. And then I produced this piece, which is sort of a curtain raiser for the orchestral work. I'm glad to say that it's commissioned very generously by the Royal Academy of Music, and it's written for Zubin Kanga, the soloist, and it is dedicated to a very good friend of mine, the composer Bernard Hughes, with much gratitude for all that he has done for me with such generosity over the years.
Now, I was wondering, when you were writing this and you had the abstracted piano part from the orchestral work in front of you, was it necessary to escape from the sounds that you'd already composed around it or alongside it? Were you able to separate it enough from that for it to become something else, or was that not the point?
I didn't try to escape from them. I actually tried to amplify them and to generate more from the same thing. And there were piano fragments which could easily have been elaborated, which is what I did. So I set up elaborated forms out of that. I called them episodes or something. And then the piece fleshed out of that. And in fact, I began to give these fragments to the pianist, Zubin Kanga. And then he worked on them, and we met, and we decided how to develop them and how to put them together. And finally, I produced the piece and gave it to him.
Well, I know you've been working on this until very recently, just a few days ago. Yeah. And
so rehearsing. He's done a remarkable job of learning a very difficult piece very quickly.
And were you surprised at what happened and what it became after you started fleshing out the piano part?
If the piece works, I'm always surprised and delighted as well, you know. And it did work. I hope it works. You will be the best judges of that. But I was very happy with the piece.
Well, we're about to hear it for the first time. I have to give the world premiere of Param Veer's Intimations of Luminous Clarity. Please welcome Zubin Kanga. Intimations of Luminous Clarity by Paramveer. We've just heard its first performance from Zubin Kanga here at the Royal College of Music in London. Thank you very much to all our young musicians, to the Royal College of Music for having us, to our audience here in the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, and most of all, of course, to Paramveer for the music.
Tonight's Proms Composer Portrait was introduced by Andrew McGregor. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 11 o'clock and now Lake Junction with Max Reinhardt.
History. Trunzong by Thundercat, a kind of 21st century Shuggy Otis. He's a bassist and producer from LA, and we'll be hearing a bit more from him later on in the programme. Before that, Gave It Away by Catherine Williams, a song she wrote about Elvis and time. I was lucky enough to see her sing it in the gothic splendour of Old St Pancras Church just a few weeks ago. Now, a tune from 1931 from Davy Miller, also known as the Blind Soldier, because he lost his sight in the US Army during the First World War. The track we're going to hear is Jailhouse Rag, seemingly a close cousin of the more famous Freight Train. Who knows which came first? Maybe you do. Tweet us at BBC Radio 3, hashtag Late Junction, or email late.junction@bbc.co.uk. Here's Davy Miller.